Chapter 2. My last recollection of the Brent Knoll era is of being visited by a rather short, quiet, and elderly man called John Cheese. He was my dad's dad, and enjoyed a reputation for being the white sheep of his family. Apparently, he disapproved so strongly of his father and brothers that he'd left home as soon as he was able, and moved miles away to Bristol to dissociate himself from them. Quite what his family got up to was never spoken of. I believe they were bakers, but that may have been a cover story they used to allow them to be up all hours of the night. My grandfather must have been in his 70s when I first met him, and in those days that was a considerable age, and I remember him walking rather slowly with the aid of a stick as he, mother, and I made our way along the Somerset lanes. He was a very formal man, restrained and careful and sedate, although he exuded a kind and gentle air. In fact, he looked just like Dr. Doolittle, and although I like being around him and recall how courteous he and Dad were to each other, I don't remember having much actual fun with him. He had one little joke in his repertoire. He would tell of a pet peacock that flew over the wall into a neighbour's garden and laid an egg. Did the egg belong to the peacock's owner or to the neighbour? When we'd guessed, he would remind us that peacocks didn't lay eggs. This was not exactly end-of-the-pier knockabout stuff, and so it did not really surprise me when I learned later that he'd passed his whole working life as a clerk in a legal firm. Grandpa was my only surviving grandparent. My mum's mother had died many years before. Judging from photographs of her, she was an elderly, rather ethereal version of Virginia Woolf. Her husband, Marwood Cross, on the other hand, was about as wraith-like as a warthog, a squat, short-tempered, assertive, graceless little man who in his time was apparently one of the most celebrated auctioneers in Weston-super-Mare. Westonians habitually used inflated language to describe each other. Doctors' names were spoken with a hushed reverence. Surgeons and architects were invariably eminent, lawyers distinguished, businessmen influential, firms prestigious, schoolmasters respected, and tobacconists renowned. Well, there were half a dozen auctioneers in Weston, and they were all prominent, notable, and self-impressed. So when my parents chose my Christian names, they took John from Grandpa and Marwood from the other oaf. Mother told me that in the future, when people asked my name and I said, John Marwood Cleese, they would look surprised and say, oh, are you by any chance related to Marwood Cross, the auctioneer? Here's a multiple choice question for you, dear listener. How many times has this actually happened to me on my 7+ decades on the planet? A, 5,000 times. B, twice. C, never. Marwood Cross was a celebrated red-faced bully who ran a tight ship. When the table was laid for meals, a cane was placed by his cutlery so that he could swat any of his children if their table manners faltered. He was also an eminent coward. When a burglar was once diagnosed in the basement, he appeared on the balcony outside his second-floor bedroom, ringing a handbell and ordering his children and the maid to go and investigate. His main form of entertainment was writing poison pen letters, which he would get my father to post from unlikely Somerset villages when he happened to pass through them in the course of his quest to sell insurance policies. Marwood was also a past master of the art of auctioneering. If he fancied the look of anything he'd been asked to auction, he'd knock it down quickly to an imaginary buyer before the bidding got going, snaffling his prey at a cutthroat price while maintaining his reputation as a pillar of the community. I'd like to apologize publicly for the fact that some of his genes are present in my body. They will be hunted down and destroyed when the technology is available. The final missing grandparent was my dad's mother. She had died in the early 20s, and I know almost nothing about her. This, I now realize, is because her death upset Dad so much that even many years later, he never talked about her. I discovered something about her by chance. When I was about 14 or so, I was rummaging through a tiny ancient suitcase that contained all his old family papers, and I found a letter that she'd written to him just before she died. When I showed it to Dad, a strange look flashed across his face, and he told me that he'd not read it again since he'd first received it. He opened it and, after a few seconds, started to sob. It was the only time I ever saw Dad cry. Later, he told me that his tears were not just for her loss, but because he always had a terrible guilt that he'd been away in India and the Far East during the last 4 years of her life. Communication and travel were so slow in those days that he wasn't able to get back in time to say goodbye. He believed that he'd let her down, that in some strange way she might have felt abandoned by him. He showed me the last page of this, her final letter to him, and how her signature trailed away towards the bottom of the page, a long, thin, straggly line, which he interpreted as her giving up. I was able, even at that young age, to realize that he'd been carrying this sorrow inside him for nearly 30 years, and that this was the reason he and Mother never mentioned my grandmother's name. Not only did I never see Dad cry again, I never heard him raise his voice in anger, nor utter the word fuck. This is because he was a gentleman in the best sense of the word, not by breeding, of course, but by acquisition of a way of behaving that was based on a set of values he admired, those of the English gentleman. During his time in the army, and after that in India and the Far East, he was able to watch some of the finest of this species, and he was so impressed by their qualities of courtesy, kindliness, modesty, light-heartedness, courage, honesty, and a constant reluctance to burden others with their problems or difficulties, that he tried to model himself on what he'd observed. But when he was born in Bristol in 1893, all of this lay in the future because his family were distinctly lower middle class. Young Reggie attended a Catholic school called St. Brendan's College, not because the Cheeses were Catholic, but because the headmaster was one of his father's best friends. He had a good, quick intelligence, but no academic interest whatsoever, so he left school early and took a job at an insurance office. One of his most endearing traits was his utter lack of ambition, which goes a long way to explain why he remained in insurance for the rest of his life. Another reason is that he was very good with figures and could do quite complicated sums in his head, and this came so naturally to him that he'd fallen out with his St. Brendan's math teacher, who insisted that he should show his workings. Reggie didn't see the point. I'm sure Dad was a useful clerk during the next few years, given his facility with arithmetic, his excellent manners, and his astute understanding of people. He was bound to have been. However, it was not in his nature to take pay without giving full value for it, but he was able to combine conscientiousness with light-heartedness. The life he led, full of japes and pranks and put-ons that he and his pals perpetrated, sounded just like the one described in his favourite book, Three Men in a Boat. He and his friends even played tricks on visitors to the insurance office, coating a walking stick with treacle, for example, so that helpful people who picked it up to hand it over to them would get sticky hands. Outside the office, they were more boisterous, but never mean or the slightest bit violent. Weston, as the nearest seaside resort, was often the setting for their antics. They would take donkey rides, set off in different directions, and then leave the donkeys in people's gardens to eat the flowers. Their most spectacular caper involved removing several small plucked chickens from a butcher's shop, smuggling them into the balcony at the winter gardens, and then, on a cue, launching them all high into the air so that they descended onto the orchestra that was playing while gentlefolk were taking afternoon tea. Dad lived at home with his parents until he was 22. With the outbreak of the First World War in the late summer of 1914, he tried to sign up, but failed the medical because he couldn't read the fourth line down on the optician's chart. Later in the war, the army became less picky, but before that happened, he'd volunteered again. This time he asked the man in front of him in the queue to memorize the line that he couldn't read and to tell him what it was on the way out. This subterfuge allowed him to join the carnage in France, albeit under an assumed name. He was fed up with being teased that he was a fermented curd, so he changed the H to an L. I never understood what he was hoping to achieve. I was always called Cheese from the very moment I arrived at school. Perhaps his regiment, the Royal Gloucesters, lacked the imagination to make the connection. After he finished his training, he was made a second lieutenant, the lowest commission rank in the army hierarchy. He never knew why he was chosen to be an officer, but he assumed it was because he spoke grammatical English. Arriving in France in 1915, he was within weeks wounded in the back and shoulders by shrapnel. The scars were still visible 30-odd years later. So he wrote a letter of resignation to his commanding officer. The army was a very gentlemanly affair in those days, and he returned to England and convalesced. Once the wounds had healed, he enlisted again, this time as a private. A shouting match ensued when the army discovered he previously served as an officer, but eventually they calmed down and agreed to let him return to France as a mere lance corporal. I always thought this was a lovably eccentric act on Dad's part, typical of his lack of interest in career advancement, until I discovered years later that the life expectancy of a junior officer on the Western Front at that time was 6 weeks. Because when an officer led his men over the top, the Germans looked for the man with a revolver and a whistle and shot him first. When, as a young boy, immediately after the Second World War, I used to accompany Dad in the car on some of his insurance trips, he would tell me not only stories from his war years, but also funny and fascinating tales of what happened to him next. Apparently, when the armistice was signed in 1918, his commanding officer asked him what he was going to do now that the war was over. And he said he planned to return to Bristol and carry on selling insurance. "No, no," cried the colonel. "You must go and see the Empire, young man." And he promptly wrote Dad a couple of letters of introduction and recommendation. And just a few weeks later, therefore, Dad found himself on a boat bound for Bombay, where, thanks to the colonel's contacts, he had secured a job selling marine insurance for the big British company called the Union of Canton. And now he began to live quite a posh life. He was no longer an insurance salesman. He was a marine underwriter. And because he looked presentable and had the right accent and excellent manners and was witty and amusing, he began mixing with middle-class people from good public schools, and even occasionally with some real toffs, many of whom proved to be friendly and good-natured and cultivated. Mind you, these people had a lot to be good-natured about. They lived like micro-princes. When Dad found a house to share, he discovered there were 14 servants attached to it. And when he suggested reducing this extraordinary number, the Indians explained with great charm and regret that he was not allowed to do this. It was his duty as an English gentleman to employ at least that number. The fellow Dad found himself sharing with was called Woodhouse, and he turned out to be a brother of the great P.G. Dad thought him immensely likeable, charming, wonderfully companionable and considerate, but oddly, seemingly without a sense of humour. What was odder, though, was the degree of Woodhouse's naivety. Like Dad, he was in his mid-twenties, but it was only when visiting a doctor in Bombay that he discovered that his foreskin was retractable. It's hard to credit that a chap could get through a couple of decades without stumbling upon this fact about a part of the body of considerable interest to most males, but I think it throws light on PG's status as a great comic writer. If his brother was as naive as this, is it possible that PG himself lacked a certain degree of worldliness, of the everyday experience of the average man about town, of actual ordinary savoir-faire? And so, is it possible that this very ingenuousness is connected with the rather simplified psychology of PG's characters, which forces me to regard him as a very good comic writer rather than a great one? Not that I have anything against naivety itself. Every single person I really like has a degree of it, and the people I detest the most are know-it-alls, but there is a point at the far end of the naivety continuum where it becomes indistinguishable from ordinary common or garden brainlessness. The question that must be faced is it more likely that a man would make a Nazi propaganda broadcast by mistake, as PG claimed he did, if he did share genes with someone who was unaware that his foreskin was retractable? To this, I believe that the answer is a resounding yes. All in all, Dad had a wonderful time in India, not least because he was not present when Woodhouse made his discovery, and he also talked of the Indians in tones of total affection. But there's no doubt it was very much a colonial master-servant relationship. Dad spoke some Hindi, but he once admitted that the only part of a Hindi verb that he ever learned was the imperative. He and his pals were a high-spirited lot, scarcely surprising given the horrendous war that they had just endured. And to put this in perspective, it has been claimed that more damage was done to buildings in Cambridge on Guy Fawkes Night of 1945 by boisterous undergraduates recently returned from fighting in Europe than was achieved by German bombers during the whole of the Second World War. They had a tendency, therefore, to behave the way rugby teams traditionally do on Saturday nights. As a rule, they were rowdy and naughty rather than nasty, but Dad did recall an occasion when things went a bit further. Apparently, a Welsh friend called Davies invited him for a drive one Sunday afternoon in his open car, and Dad was surprised, as he climbed into the back seat behind the chauffeur, to find a small pile of bricks there. He pointed them out to Davies, who said he would explain what they were for in due course. 10 minutes later, Davies picked one up and lobbed it through the front window of a shop they were passing. The Indian chauffeur found this as amusing as his employer. Dad was astonished, but reflected that at least it was a Sunday and the shop was shut. Dad's misbehaviour was relatively low-key. He kept a letter, which he treasured, from a famous Bombay hotel, barring him from entering its precincts again, and listing at length his various pranks involving butter dishes and trays of that classic Anglo-Indian dish kedgeree, and the launching of other edible projectiles. But once he became a member of the Royal Bombay Yacht Club, I suspect his conduct improved. He relished mixing with real live gentlemen, and I can see now that his admiration of them also involved studying their demeanour and habits and mimicking them. And in due course, teaching some of it to me. Never look startled, my boy. Move slowly. If someone drops something and you want to look, wait a few seconds and then turn round in a leisurely way and glance. Don't stare. The only blight on Dad's sojourn in India was that he caught malaria, which was to afflict him for years to come. When an attack came, all he could do was to retreat to his bed for several days, trembling and sweating, teeth chattering, feeling so weak he could do nothing but stay there, patiently losing weight. After 3 years in India, the unit of Canton transferred him to their Hong Kong office, and shortly afterwards he was retransferred to their main office in Canton. Outside the British Empire for the first time, he saw things that made Bombay look like Cheltenham. He visited an opium den, he got tattoos, and he ate a dog. I'll rephrase that. He ate a delicious dish, which he subsequently discovered was dog. He also had a clerk working for him who he much liked, a Chinese chap who spoke excellent English and was charming and highly competent. One day, however, he did not turn up at the office. Inquiries were made, and it turned out he was in jail. Dad typically went straight to the prison and asked to see the governor, who greeted him most courteously and explained that his clerk had been found guilty of illegal political activities. Dad asked how long he would have to be in prison, and the governor said, "I am afraid we are executing him in the morning." I used to think it was extraordinary that shortly after this, Dad was to be found back in Weston-super-Mare. Had he also been engaged in illegal political activities? Was he feeling bad about the dog? Apparently it was truly scrumptious, so he could have been removing himself from further temptation. Or was he just tired of excitement? Actually, the answer was simple. Malaria. The attacks had weakened him, and he was worried that unless he removed himself to cooler climes, he might kick the bucket. And as it was, by the time he got back to Blighty, his weight was down to about 11 ounces, which is not much for a man of 6 feet. He was the standard bag of bones. The attacks continued for several years before they started to peter out. Meanwhile, he was one of the few in Weston on quinine. But first, he went down to Bristol to visit his father, whom he'd not seen for 5 years, and stayed there to recuperate while his spinster sister, Dorothy, looked after him. They were very fond of each other, spent a lot of time together, engrossed in their common interest, smoking. Dad had formed a habit of 40 a day, untipped, and Dorothy matched him stub for stub. Despite this, he slowly regained his health and started making excursions to the nearest seaside town, which happened to be dear old Weston-super-Mare. While visiting, he bumped into Mother. They started walking out together, despite Marwood demanding she should be home by 10 o'clock. She was 26. And they fell in love. Within just a few months, they decided to get married. And here's the romantic bit. They eloped. Well, they had to. They came from families of different social class, and there was no way that Marwood Cross was going to give his blessing to a wedding between his daughter and a commoner. Well, not a commoner, exactly, just someone commoner. The gap in status between Muriel Cross and this dubious tattooed proletarian lounge lizard was unbridgeable. You see, Dad came from, at best, the middle-lower middle class, or to be exact, he was middle-middle-lower middle class, whereas Muriel Cross came from the great auctioneering house of Marwood Cross, who was almost middle-middle class. Their lowest possible social classification was upper-upper-lower middle class. And so, as far as Marwood was concerned, a morganatic arrangement was out of the question. So Dad and Mum eloped to London, to the far-off, urbane, cosmopolitan, liberal-minded heart of the British Empire, where nobody gave a solitary hoot for an inflated, half-witted provincial auctioneer with his head up his upper-upper-lower-middle-class arse. Freedom, in Golders Green, where for 2 years they lived happily, and Dad acquired so many Jewish friends that he picked up a surprising amount of Yiddish. These fellows took great pleasure in introducing Dad to their unsuspecting Jewish friends, just to see the expression on their faces when this unmistakable goy launched into a volley of Central European demotic. I think Dad was secretly proud of his Jewish connections in an age where there was so much prejudice. He did what he could to work against it, although he was prepared, with Mother, to make an exception of the Welsh. This is a well-established West Country trait, and rooting it out will take many generations, I fear. But then destiny moved against them. A reconciliation took place with Marwood Cross, and so, inevitably, they moved back to Weston-super-Mare and lived there reasonably happily, at least until I arrived, also in Weston, in October 1939, a mere 13 years after their wedding. It seems that in the world of the Cleeses, all roads lead to Weston fucking super fucking mayor. By the time Dad was regaling me with his memories of India, though, we had taken up residence in a small seaside town called Burnham-on-Sea, a few miles down the coast from Weston. Burnham plays an important part in British history because it was here that a bee killed Viscount Montgomery of Alamein's first wife. Monty loved her very much, and had she survived the sting, he might well have settled down to a happy retirement. As it was, he went off to North Africa to defeat Rommel. And the reason for our move to Burnham, assuming there was one, was to allow me, at the age of 6, to start at a proper school. The problem was that my parents picked a real stinker. My recollections of it seem to come straight out of Dickens. Two large, rather dark rooms illuminated by fire, with 15 or so children, all older than me, working in small groups, supervised by a solitary, curt, menacing old crone, who seemed to assume that I should know what I was supposed to be doing without actually bothering to tell me. After a couple of days of bewildered anxiety, things came to a head. The sour old cow gave me a sum much more difficult than any I had encountered before. Say, a four-digit number divided by a three-digit number. I guessed how to do it and got it wrong. Without offering help, she told me to do it again. I failed a second time. She warned me to try harder. I did. I failed again. She told me to hold my hand out, and grasping it firmly, she caned the palm three times hard. My first reaction was astonishment. None of my kindergartens had been Catholic establishments, so I was unprepared for this kind of assault. Then it hurt a lot. My precious palm! When I first started having therapy 25 years later, this was one of the first traumas I recalled, and I was astonished at the power of the feelings that came flooding back. Anger? No, fury. Self-pity, humiliation, a deep, deep sense of hurt, and a pure indignation, not so much at the unfairness, but the insanity of punishing someone physically for getting an answer wrong. It's terrifying how much of this deeply unkind, utterly pointless, in fact, mind-bogglingly counterproductive kind of behaviour was meted out to children over the centuries by half-witted, power-crazed zombies like this heinous old bat. A large proportion of such psychopaths allegedly acting in the name of an all-loving God. A friend of mine attended a school run by Carthusian brothers. When one boy in class made a mistake, the priest produced a strap, asked the question again, and raised the strap to strike the boy if he repeated his error. And the boy remarked, "Well, that's not going to help, is it?" But I may have learned something from my brush with sadism. The strongest feeling of all that re-emerged in this therapy session of mine was the final one that bubbled up, an extraordinary steely determination that I was not going to let this happen again. Somehow, something stirred somewhere in my precious 6-year-old heart, which suggested I might have a couple of vertebrae knocking around somewhere, and that one day I might get to use them. So grim was this first experience of school that Dad took me away from the nightmare establishment the next day and enrolled me in Miss Creswell's Academy, a really nice, kind, happy and friendly school, where I coloured pictures of mice in hats and then cut them out neatly with scissors. Thus, I began to rebuild my academic confidence and resume my wussy lifestyle. Looking back, I realized I was a fairly quiet and solitary child, though not a lonely one. Mother said that as a baby, I never cried. I probably thought that if I did, she might appear. And ever since I read the psychologist Hans Eysenck's wonderfully clear account of introverts and extroverts, I've known I am definitely one of the former. Of course, there's a continuum between one extreme and the other, with certain individuals called ambiverts falling in the middle, with both tendencies in roughly equal proportions. For some people, the words only conjure up the caricatures at either end. The tongue-tied, painfully shy Swedish archivist at one end, the loud, insensitive Midwestern car salesman at the other. Such folk assume actors must be extroverts, but a lot aren't. Many performers are big presences on stage, but quite shy off. There is, after all, a huge difference between pretending you're someone else and being yourself. Eysenck also said that introverts have a naturally high level of mental activity, so they are seldom bored and in need of stimulation, because they have enough going on in their heads already. Extroverts, on the other hand, have a lower level of psychic activity. They are prone to boredom, and so need a lot of external stimulation to keep them alert. And that confirms my view that I'm an introvert. I'm never bored, except when I'm trapped at a dinner party by people who are bent on impressing me. But I feel overwhelmed, whether it's by a huge visual display at Harrods, or by too many emails and phone calls, or by hordes of people coming up to me on public occasions, each one determined to tell me, "We have something in common." My sister's husband was at Clifton College about 20 years after you, and he used to go to the same sports store where they said you had once bought a pair of batting gloves. No.
Really?
But I've learned to function perfectly well in extroverted situations and to enjoy them, although afterwards I seem to need a bit of peace and quiet. On the other hand, if I spend the day writing, then I really look forward to a social evening. It's not black and white. It's more a question of balance. Certainly, as a 6, 7, or 8-year-old, I spent more time on my own and with my parents than with my contemporaries. I played happily alone, running a shop with the help of my stuffed animals, making Meccano models, modelling plasticine, collecting postcards of British birds, and drawing and painting without revealing a shred of talent. I loved comics, reading them with great care as though I was trying to understand what motivated the characters. Thus, I acquired the idea that kicking people's bottoms was very funny, although in practice this didn't make them laugh as much as it should have. I needed to spend more time with kids of my age. So one evening my parents arranged for me to have supper with two boys who lived in the same block of flats, and we listened to a 15-minute radio serial called Dick Barton's Special Agent. The adrenaline rush this caused flowed for several days, and my parents decided the experience should not be repeated too often. Another time, I was left with some nice boys and girls for a few hours, and with my eyes on the end of stalks, watch them playing Monopoly. I'd simply never realized that life could be so thrilling. I could imagine myself actually joining in and playing a game like this when I was a few years older and it was safe to do so. Two things about myself I'm at a loss to explain. I suddenly became fascinated by cars, and I would sit in the back of our little Austin 10, calling out the names of the oncoming cars with great accuracy. Lagonda, Humber, MGM, Woolsey, Hillman Minx, Jowett Javelin. Then, one day, I completely lost interest in them, overnight. From that moment on, they bored me rigid. Nowadays, I assume that anybody reading a car magazine must be geeky. People comparing the advantages and disadvantages of competing models of motor cars and showing off their detailed knowledge. Are they insane? One of my greatest fears is to be a key witness in a complicated car pile-up. The police interviewing me would think I was sending them up. Even odder was my support for Australia at cricket. Where did that come from? I mean, Dad talked with great affection about the South Africans and the Aussies and the Canadians he'd met during the war, but why would I suddenly decide to become an expert on Australian cricketers of the 20s and 30s? I knew them all, Woodfull and Ponsford, Bradman, McCartney, McCabe, Kippax, Richardson, Oldfield, Clary Grimmett, who was a Kiwi who played for Oz and who could spin a ball so hard it would turn at right angles on a snooker table, Bill O'Reilly, Fleetwood Smith, the worst batsman Test cricketers ever seen, and the awe-inspiringly fast-bowling partnership of McDonald and Gregory. Dad and I invented a form of living room cricket to get us through the winter, which involved bowling a ping-pong ball at a tiny bat held in front of a wooden matchbox holder. And while he was always Hobbs or Sutcliffe or Harold Larwood, I was always the Australians. And this strange, quasi-patriotic attachment lasted until the mid-50s, when I finally switched my allegiance to the England team. I have not the faintest, remotest, tiniest scintilla of an idea why I once cheered for the Aussies. And talking of rum behaviour, round that time something happened that puzzled me a lot. Mrs. Phillips, an old lady who lived in a flat upstairs, sent a message asking me to visit her, as she had something she wanted to give me. I can clearly remember climbing the stairs. They were rather steep, and she was sitting at the top in an armchair, gripping something. She told me to hold my hand out and took my fingertips to steady it, and then stabbed my palm with a specially sharpened stick. It was one of the thin wooden tapers which people used to help light fires, and she'd trimmed the business end into a point. Now, A healthy, slightly more masculine boy would have taken the taper from her and put her eyes out with it. But being me, I screamed like a stuck pig and howled and sobbed and... What? That was the whole memory. And what fascinates me is, what had I done to deserve it? Because clearly I must have done something for which Mrs. Phillips was punishing me. This palm stabbing was not part of an established pattern of behaviour on her part. In Burnham-on-Sea, gossip travelled fast. A good bowel movement could not have been hushed up for long. And Mrs. Phillips was classified as highly respectable. Could she perhaps have gone berserk for these two brief minutes of her life and then resumed normal service the rest of her days? Not, fortunately, to be reckoned in their hundreds. Or had I done something sneaky and dark and woodsheddy? Certainly nothing sexual, for at that age I had no idea what a girl's penis would look like, but something sordid, like putting mustard on her birthday cake, or hiding a spider in her pencil box, or flaying her hamster. I have a strong suspicion that I'd perpetrated something vaguely shoddy. What else could possibly explain Mrs. Phillips' premeditated behaviour, the careful planning, the ingenious choice of weapon, the meticulous sharpening, the crafty invitation, the sudden ambush? What was it revenge for? Or was she just bored? I shall never know. And I shall never know whether or not I should feel ashamed. Not that I am pretending that I led an entirely blameless life at this time. I did, for example, make a brief foray into the world of crime. I stole a submarine. Agreed, it wasn't a very sophisticated submarine, just a 3-inch-long piece of grey lead, shaped roughly like a submarine, worth about 1p at 2016 prices, which I'd come across at a party. But I did sneakily purloin it, both knowing it was not mine and in full knowledge that what I was doing was something wrong. Somehow, I must have given myself away, because Dad worked out that I had thieved it and suggested that I take it back and apologize, which I did. Although, when I told my victims I'd taken something that belonged to them, I think they were a bit surprised when I produced this tiny lead submarine. They'd assumed that the loot would be a bit more substantial. Dad, though, never harped on about what I'd done. He simply explained I shouldn't have taken it and then got me to return it. End of lesson. I was very lucky to have a dad like that. But now a big thing happens. We have been visiting prep schools in the area, and they all seem rather large and severe and forbidding. But Dad explains that we will be moving to Weston-super-Mare so that I can go to a very nice school there called St. Peter's as a day boy. I've often been to Weston, and it's huge. I mean, not as big as Bristol, where Grandpa lives, but really big, with a grand pier with a sign saying, "The largest covered amusement park in the world," and a winter gardens and 3 miniature golf courses. More importantly, it so happens that in August, the Somerset County cricket team comes to Clarence Park to play 3 3-day matches in a row, and Dad takes me to one of them to show me how exciting it will be living in Weston, and I am immediately smitten. Just the one match, but it's a start. I've fallen in love for the first time with cricket and the Somerset team, especially Bertie Bewes, whose moustache is like Dad's. When I got back to Burnham, I organised a cricket match and I made a century. There were only 2 other players, my Dick Barton friends, but I smashed the tennis ball all round our back garden and achieved a 23-ball 100. Turned out to be the only century I ever made. So, at the beginning of September 1948, we moved to Weston to the ground floor of a small house on a road called Clarence Park North, right next to the cricket ground, to enter a preparatory school called St. Peter's, where the teachers were mostly men, where there were grown-up boys of 12 and even 13, and where the headmaster was bald and absolutely enormous.